From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 25th day of March, 2019. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Pete Manhart. He's at Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Kirk Kimmel is out of the office this afternoon. A bit later in the program, Nathan Klucheski, plant pathologist for University of Illinois Extension, will join us to talk about fungicide applications and soybeans. And then as we close out our time together, we'll take a look at the weather forecast, and we'll also explore the Friday USDA reports and get a thought or two about acreage numbers from Todd Hubbs right here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We're now joined by Pete Manhart. He's at Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, to take a look at what happened in Chicago for the day. Hey, good afternoon to you, Pete. It's been a long time since we talked. Thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon.
So it looked like it was a pretty quiet day in the trade, overnight and tonight both. Was that expected or not?
I think it was expected. We're still waiting for news because of the wet weather of any acreage shifts that come out later this week from the expected numbers. And we also don't know what the China agreement will say. China said they're going to continue to supposedly buy from us before that agreement is signed. So that's helped support things. But in general, late planting would be less 8 bushels per acre on corn or less acres. It would also mean more bean acres possibly. But then the China agreement, how many more beans will they buy? How much corn will they buy? So we basically just had a good support underneath it without much else happening.
Yeah, so later in the week, on Friday, we will get the USDA reports. Both the grain stocks and the acreage numbers are due at 11 o'clock. And speaking of Chinese buying, they purchased apparently last week for delivery, I think, for this year, right, for the marketing year 18-19 of corn, somewhat 300,000 metric tons. Is that right?
300,000 metric tons, correct, and that's the first big number they've had. But we'd heard that number last week already, and it was official today.
Yeah, so that one is officially in the books. Is there any reason to believe that the Chinese will continue to buy yet in this marketing year?
I think there is, but they're going to buy when they want to. But the idea of them buying this and their continued talk is they're going to continue to buy when needed, even though we don't have any signed agreement yet.
As you mentioned earlier in our discussion, Robert Lighthizer and other trade advisors are headed, I think, Thursday and Friday this week to China, and some of their prime negotiators are coming to Washington, D.C. next week. Any indication that this is getting close to being done, or are they still just working through a lot of details?
I think they're still working on details, but I think the gist of it is we're going to get something done. We just have to finish up the fine-tuning, and it's going to be a positive influence, and that's what the trade is looking at.
Hey, anything else before I let you go for the day?
Just the weather. How wet is wet out west? When will we dry out here? We had rains over the weekend in a lot of the Midwest that might have kept us out of the field a while yet. When are we going to get into the field? We can get into the field and get things done very quickly. So it's basically weather.
Hey, thanks so much, Pete.
Have a great one.
You too. Pete Manhart is with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. In today's agricultural news, President Donald Trump over the weekend approved Iowa's federal disaster request, which detailed $1.6 billion in damage from catastrophic flooding across the region. Governor Kim Reynolds said the damage to agriculture totals at least $214 million from livestock losses and swamped farmland and grain storage sites. Speaking of which, those floodwaters came into contact with a whole lot of grain bins across much of the western Corn Belt. Kerry Crawford from USDA has more on the losses.
Farmers in parts of Nebraska, Iowa, and South Dakota may have lost farm structures and livestock to the floodwaters, but what about grain and soybeans that may have had stored in bins in the path of those waters? A University of Nebraska expert says one thing is for sure.
Any grain that has touched floodwater is contaminated because we don't know what's in the water. So these grains need to be destroyed.
But Dr. Aaron Yoder told a special flood-related webinar on Thursday it might not be a total loss. Research shows
that when we store grain and it's flooded, the moisture really doesn't travel too far up into the grain, maybe more than a foot. So the grain that's above the flood line would still be usable, but we can't take it out of the bin in the normal process, or we'd be passing it through the contaminated. So we'll have to have different methods of removing that grain.
And there are ways to do that, but limits on what you can do with that grain. Any reconditioning needs consent of FDA, and the grain has to be tested thoroughly for contaminants. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Let's stay with the floodwaters in the western Corn Belt. The damage assessments from Iowa and Nebraska now total about $3 billion, and both states' preliminary estimates could rise as floodwaters recede and further accounting is completed. Other states in the region have also experienced severe flooding, including Missouri, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Illinois. The Missouri River is expected to continue surging this week, and government forecasters are warning that historic widespread flooding could continue through May due to above-average rainfall and rapidly melting snow. Let's check in on the trade negotiations with China now. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, Deputy USTR Jeffrey Gerrish, and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin are set to travel to China Thursday of this week. A Chinese delegation to D.C. the following week will be led by Vice Premier Liu He. He's Beijing's trade negotiator in chief. There's still no meeting scheduled yet between Chinese President Xi Jinping and President Donald J. Trump. China last week bought some 300,000 tons of U.S. corn, its largest purchase of U.S. grain since October of 2013. Over the weekend, top Chinese economic officials said Beijing is ready to open the Chinese economy to greater market-based competition and imports. Staying in Washington, a forthcoming government analysis on the new North American Free Trade Pact, that's the USMCA, has some potential economic impact and is expected to be influential in shaping how some lawmakers view the deal. Here's the problem for the White House. The long-awaited report from the U.S. International Trade Commission, expected to be released around April 19, is likely to show only a slight boost in economic growth, or maybe even a negative effect from the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. That's according to longtime trade analysts like Laura Baumann of the Trade Partnership Worldwide, who predicted a GDP boost of just 0.1% from the deal. Such forecasts could make it much harder for the Trump administration to persuade skeptical Democrats to support his signature trade achievement. You know, Friday morning, the United States Department of Agriculture will release its annual acreage survey. The agricultural economist at the University of Illinois tasked with tracking acreage says he thinks there will be about 91.8 million acres of corn planted this season. And Todd Hubbs says soybean acreage should be around 85.7 million acres.
I'm getting a little nervous about soybean acreage. We've seen the prices through the early part of this year being a little bit higher relative to corn than what we would expect based on the ending stocks we're seeing. And I could see some farmers throughout the Corn Belt, particularly if they had problems with field work and with fertilizer prices where they are, deciding maybe to plant soybean acreage.
Well, this would be especially true if planting in the Midwest were to be delayed further by poor early season weather conditions. USDA's prospective plantings report is due at 11 a.m. Central this Friday morning. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, joined now by Nathan Kluczewski, who's an extension plant pathologist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, to talk about soybeans and fungicides. There's been a lot of anecdotal evidence that there is a yield bump. I wondered whether that really was true or not and why it would be the case. I asked Nathan Kluczewski if he had any assessment.
Well, we do know that when we're applying that, if say we're in the southern part of the state and we have a lot of pressure from frog eye leaf spot, that definitely is a yield robber. And if you're planting a susceptible variety of soybean and and you're in an area where there's frog eye leaf spot, definitely you're going to see some impact if the conditions are favorable for frog eye leaf spot. I think that's our number one yield robber in soybeans. As you get further north, we get out of the frog eye leaf spot zone and we start entering white mold territory, and that's a whole different beast right there. And so we're talking about making applications that can help protect yield in some situations, but they're not going to maybe give you complete 100% what you expect if that disease takes off. So you do have situations where you're definitely going to see some pretty significant yield responses with fungicides in soybeans, provided that, you know, you're in the right conditions.
So are we talking about below Effingham and above I-80?
So I-80 and above, I would say, is more of the white mold territory. And then, yeah, you get past that kind of what I call the waste belt of Illinois, then you start to hit more of the frog eye leaf spot territory. This past year, because of all the rain we had, I think we had more frog eye leaf spot across the state than normal. Whether or not it was at levels that was really yield limiting, I can't say, but I do know that they were seeing it in parts of the state where normally it's not observed at that kind of level. In the southern part of the state, it's almost an annual thing. Further south you go, frog eye leaf spot likes it warm and humid, and that seems to be a pretty good environment for it.
What should farmers, in your mind, be watching for as it relates to the work you do?
So one of the things we're focusing on in our lab is we're really trying to build understanding of nematodes and the impact they have both on corn and soybean. So it's not just about soybean cyst nematode. Of course, there's this big push with the Soybean Cyst Nematode Coalition, sampling your fields, understanding HG types, and that's all important. But we're also interested in other nematodes as well, not just pathogenic, but the whole picture. And we want to see what we can do to manage nematodes in a way that can impact yield in an economically friendly way. And so that's kind of some of the things we're getting at now. We're running surveys, trying to get a good picture of where things are at in the state, map that out, and that will give growers an idea of if they're in a high-risk area or not. And then we can kind of laser focus in on those areas and tailor management strategies to those particular growers. We're also working with my colleague Santiago Medeiros in our department, and we're focusing in a little bit on Phytophthora sojae, which is a soil-borne disease in soybeans that what we found last year is there's some confusion in terms of resistance, the types of resistance and how it works. And what we're trying to do there is develop a tool that will allow growers to quickly access the pathotypes in their fields. And if they know their pathotypes, they can select better varieties that have the right resistance to the pathotypes in their field. So that's something that's kind of early stage, 4 or 5 years out, but that's where we're going with that. So in soybeans, those are the two things we're working on. Corn, obviously, tar spot is a big thing. And we're always interested in economics and trying to figure out what's the best way to make growers money. So that's really where we're focusing in here early on.
The sojae disease, is it Phytophthora root rot, or is that what
root
that is?
Root rot and stem rot is the same thing.
Right.
It's caused by Phytophthora sojae, and there's a second organism called Phytophthora.
It's the causal agent. Okay. Yeah, because causal agent.
And right. So one of the things, if you look at your seeds, say you pull out your, say we go to Pioneer and we look at their seed ratings, they'll have Phytophthora race, they call it race resistance, and they'll have the different genes in there. Those genes are only effective against specific pathotypes. And so your field can have many different pathotypes in it, and knowing what proportion you have is going to be important, because those genes will only be effective against certain types of Phytophthora sojae in your field.
Now, coming back to the cyst nematode, mm-hmm. Because farmers certainly will be familiar with it, they'll mm-hmm. probably be familiar that at least they used to have to look for PI88788 mm-hmm. And Peking
sure.
To check for resistance. Has that changed at all with the populations? Have the populations become resistant to that?
Right, and so because we have so many, I think, again, the numbers, Greg Tilke has a fabulous chart showing this, how many of the cultivars out there have PI88788 versus Peking. It's amazing. I mean, it's 99% have PI88788. Then there's Peking and a couple that don't have anything, right? And as you can imagine, it's like anything. It's like with insecticides, herbicides, fungicides. If you keep exposing a population of a pathogen or an insect to the same quote-unquote mode of action, eventually they find ways around it. And that's sort of what we're seeing with the soybean cyst nematode. You have subsets of the population that can continue to grow and reproduce on PI88788, and it's not as effective as it was, say, 15, 20 years ago. When those first cultivars came out, you could see drastic reductions in your SCN, and you didn't have to think about it. Now it's like, okay, we got to start thinking about it again, and how are we going to better manage this? And that's where we're at right now, both from an extension standpoint, building awareness, and a research standpoint, figuring out, all right, what are the new tools? How are we going to use this and deliver it to growers?
It's amazing that this being a problem that Greg Knoll-Saul described, and he was a nematologist here on campus at the U of I, in a 3,000-year-old Chinese text. Just amazing that this has been around for that right. long a time. Thank right. you so much, and thanks for all the work you're doing.
Absolutely, no problem.
Nathan Klichowski is an extension plant pathologist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Let's check in now with the Andersons from right here in Champaign County to see what the cash grain situation is like. Greg Johnson joins us. Good afternoon to you, Greg. Thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon, Todd.
I'd like to know what basis levels have been up to over the last week or so.
Corn basis continues to get a little bit better. We anticipate it improving by about 3 to 4 cents every month, so that's about a penny a week, and that's what we saw this week. We didn't improve last week, but we improved 2 cents this week. So we're on pace for about a penny improvement per week in corn. And bean basis levels are improving, not quite as fast, but they are improving. So we're just kind of covering the cost of storage and interest over time. And so basis levels continue to improve. I don't think it's anything as a result of the weather situation out west. We haven't really seen that translate into much higher basis levels in the near term. We kind of thought maybe we would, but we haven't seen that yet. So I guess at this point it's just kind of steady, a penny a week better for the most part.
Why do you think it hasn't translated into better basis to the east?
I just don't think the export demand has really picked up yet. There's stocks in places, and I think that they can get that to the Gulf, for example, without the problems that we've experienced out west. So if we see the PNW market pick up and BNN can't get rail out there, then we may start seeing that, but we haven't seen it yet. So I think this takes a little bit of time, especially when we haven't seen the big export, the robust export demand that we're used to. So that probably is limiting it a little bit at this point.
So for PNW, you would be thinking about soybeans, but the Chinese did buy corn.
They did buy a little bit of corn. That is correct. And like I say, I think there's enough corn stocks in position right now to handle what limited amount of corn has been purchased by the Chinese. Now, if they continue to buy more, then that's going to be an issue, but it hasn't been yet.
What are producers calling and asking about more often than not?
When will the funds stand up and take notice about the wet weather and the delayed potential planting progress?
Are they disappointed in your answer?
Well, it's March, and we say call back in 30 days or 45 days, and if it's still a problem, then I think the traders may, start sitting up and taking notice. But it's March 25th, so it's not on the forefront yet, but it's on the back burner. It's in people's minds.
And what are your bids for the day?
Cash corn today, 361. New corn, 372. Cash beans, 872. New beans, 880. Cash wheat, 463. And new crop wheat, 455.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Todd.
That's Greg Johnson with the Andersons.